Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Happy Mum, Happy Baby, the podcast. Today's guest is an actress, a comedian, mother of three boys, and I have been watching her on TV for as long as I can remember. It is the amazing, oh, and I should add, she's a documentary maker. That's very important. It's the amazing Sally Phillips.
Hey, thank you.
Hello, how are you?
Yeah, all right. A tiny bit insane. How about you?
Oh, I've got to say, so we're actually recording this on the first day of, essentially, it's the easing of the lockdown, but it's not really. There's just some new rules put into place that mean that you can still stand 2 metres away from people, but only one person. We're still basically indoors with our kids, and it's crazy.
Apart from, can we go to garden centres?
Yes, you can. If you want to buy some plants this afternoon, Sally, that's where you're going.
Yeah, I want to go because I did that thing with the kids where I was trying to, we did lots of growing sunflowers.
Yeah.
I've realised I need to get the...
The bamboo.
Yeah,
the
bamboo. Yeah, the sticks. The stakes.
Oh, is that what they're actually called? I love it. So talking about the documentary, going there, the reason I've always wanted you on anyway, but then when I watched the documentary and saw the chaos of you with three boys, I was like, that's my home. And it is just loud and chaotic and you've just got to get involved. There's no way that you can just stand on the sidelines and just let it, yeah, you're involved.
Yeah, I worked with somebody called Pippa Evans, who's a really brilliant comedian and singer. And she said her mother was an artist and she used to get old rolls of wallpaper out of the shed and fill all the potties with paint. And they would do, the kids would do bum prints down the wallpaper, bunny hopping. And I was so taken by that. I thought, that's the kind of family I want. I want that kind of, everyone a bit messy. But I didn't quite, I'm slightly too prudish to just do bum prints. But we got into this habit when we've sort of stopped it now. But for a long time, we used to do, they call it, the kids call it slidey painting. We get old, huge rolls of paper or cardboard out. And, you know, there's some... tubes of paint from the early learning centre.
Yeah.
And they would just throw paint at each other, throw paint at the, on the grass, throw paint on the paper, and then do whole body prints. And it's their it was their favourite thing. And the beginning of the documentary, it was Luke's birthday, and so as a treat, we had slidey painting. We had the paint out.
So they
had
a massive
paint right. Yeah. And the garden used to look cool, you know. Used to look like some kind of Hindu religious ceremony. Trees painted pink. So, yeah, so they've got sort of sensory needs. Ollie's Down syndrome has meant that we've needed to do loads of hands-on, messy play. So we were sort of in for a penny, in for a pound, once you've started rubbing your baby's feet in trays of gravel. And lots of, you know, that corn flour and water tracing. Yeah. On baking trays, lots, you know, it evolves from there.
I always find that for me, my kids have never been the ones that sit down with a pen and paper and just do nice, delicate stuff. I look whenever we have gone out to restaurants in the past, I just look over in such awe of the families who are sat just calmly doing that. They need something actually to be doing. It's a very different thing.
Very, very different. There's a cushion, there's an inflatable cushion with rubber spikes on it. And I found they'd sit a little bit more cut. So it's gives them some sensory feedback. So if you've got a really wriggly child, yeah, you can sit them. It looks like something you'd find in the torture garden. apart from it's blue, not black. But kids, not that I've ever been to the torture garden, I do have to say, but I've seen pictures. This is all going horribly wrong already. But yeah, but it gives them a bit of sensory feedback. So they I find mine are more likely to sit still. It's like they sit stiller on a bouncy ball. Yeah, just engaging their core a bit more. Mm. Yeah.
Sally, what was your childhood like?
My dad worked for British Airways, and so we lived abroad and we moved country about every year and a half.
Where did you live?
Far East, Middle East. I was born in Hong Kong, then Zambia, then Bandar Seri Begawan in Borneo, and then Abu Dhabi, Dubai, Bahrain, Beirut, Rome, Sydney, and then back.
So do you speak lots of different languages?
At one stage, I spoke a few. I do lots of different accents. We were revising for a son's French oral exam, and I said, "Comment est ton anniversaire?" I said, "When's your birthday?" And he went, "My birthday is." I knew at that stage that we were not going to pass. So yeah, we all do a lot of accents, but not so many actual languages.
Well, I think the accent thing is lots of fun, so really? I'd keep that. So what was it like moving around a lot as a child?
Yeah, well, I'm really grateful for it now. It meant that our family was a real little unit. So, you know, friendships didn't continue, which was difficult because it's really hard to keep friendships up across continents before you can write, for example, as a kid. And, you know, we didn't have Zoom and Skype, obviously, then. So we got a very sort of strong family culture, and we're very close. And I guess in some ways it was quite disruptive. And as an adult, I've had to work through, I didn't know for a long time how to repair relationships when they went wrong. Because that's what you learn, isn't it? Where you grow up with the same group of people. You fall out and you forgive each other. But if you're moving all the time, then if you fall out, you never see them again. And that's, you don't really learn how to do that. So I've had to learn how to do that. But really, it was really enriching. I mean, now the world's got so much smaller. I feel really grateful to be, it's called being a third culture kid. When you're a child who's been brought up in neither of your parents' country of origin. And so there's a whole load of slight insanities that go with that. But at the same time, lots of richness, you know. Cooking and things like that, lots of great family recipes that are basically Middle Eastern. And I find I sort of fit into lots of different environments very quickly. So then what I've had to learn is how to hang on to myself. So I learned how to completely adapt. And then you find a lot of actors are like this, that they adapt very quickly. They can fake being part of a group very quickly, but it takes a while to work out exactly what it is you like and, you know, not to get too deep.
Did you ever think ahead to you as a mum and whether you wanted a family of your own?
I didn't at all. It's really weird. I didn't. And I think that's partly to do with not having this community around you and being from a specific place. So I wasn't looking at other families thinking, oh, I want to be like that. I was just, you know, let's just keep afloat today. So, yeah, I didn't imagine getting married and I didn't imagine having children. I definitely wasn't Muriel from Muriel's Wedding. Yeah. And the Bowdoin catalogue leaves me cold.
Still now,
weirdly. But we used to come back to the UK every summer for it. And my parents would try to make us British and we would have these British holidays. So we'd go to the Lake District and we'd, you know, it was so exotic for us to go and sit on a, you know, us who were, going to beaches in Africa and all the rest of it, to go to a British beach with stones on it and have an ice cream, have a Mr. Whippy and sit on one of those, what are they called, ride-ons, you know, on the seafront.
Yeah.
And have rock and go tadpoling. These were all... Because I guess I was still brought up with those books. So I was brought up with that very English childhood in literature.
Yeah.
And have kind of, I suppose, try to do that a bit with my children. But I didn't actually experience that myself.
Yeah. So you didn't ever think about yourself as a mum, But at what point did you kind of go, actually, that's what I'd quite like? And were you already acting by that point as well? Because I imagine as an actor, it's quite difficult to sort of say, this is going really well, but hold on a minute, I've got to make a little bit of time to have a chat. Like, is that difficult kind of in your head working out if you can? Because I've got loads of friends who are actors and they find it really difficult to kind of go, actually, I'm gonna take this time.
I weirdly had in my head that 27 was the age when one got married and had kids.
This is the third time I've heard this week. Yep.
20, have you heard that age?
Yes, yeah.
Really? It's so strange, isn't it? It's like 27. And then 27 came and went and I went into a bit of a panic. I was like, I'm officially on the shelf. This is a disaster. And so then once I got married at 31, my husband definitely wanted a year without children, which is probably very wise. And then they got cracking straight away. So I had this sense that I needed to get on with it, which is quite interesting because I had Ollie, who has Down syndrome. He was my first child. And then once I became a geriatric mother, my other two kids don't have Down syndrome. But I had, you know, I had my child with Down syndrome before I was a geriatric first mother, first time mom.
Crazy. When do you become geriatric? Is it 35?
35, yeah.
It's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah.
So what was it like, the first pregnancy? The first time sort of going through all of that?
Yeah, I mean, I was really freaked out, is the truth. I didn't enjoy being pregnant at all. I got really fat instantly. I got very anxious about work. My husband wasn't working at the time and I got very anxious about supporting the family. And I think I thought people would employ you pregnant, but it turns out that they would rather have an actress wearing a fake bump than employ a real pregnant person because of the insurance. And so I ended up doing these voiceovers for Summerfield. I'd never really done any adverts before. Going in every week and going, boneless leg of pork, half price. This week, box of Quality Street, half price, bottle of Chardonnay, as I got bigger and bigger and bigger. And I was pretty miserable pregnant. And I now realise, I think my body was, you know, trying to get the right nutrients for Ollie.
Mm-hmm.
And so at about 5 months, I went to see a nutritionist naturopath who put me on some super strong vitamins, and that gave me my brain back to some extent, and I think probably made a huge difference to Ollie. I mean, I think we're only just starting to find out the impact you can have with nutritional treatments for babies with learning disabilities in the womb, so it's just sort of a beginning area, but I think I was pretty lucky with that. And then Ollie didn't turn. And that's quite common with kids with Down syndrome, because they've got poor tone. So then I tried to have him turned, which is the single most painful thing.
Really? I've heard not very nice things about that.
Really not nice, and it didn't work. So then I ended up with a cesarean. And Ollie's Down syndrome wasn't diagnosed until 10 days after birth. So it was a really happy time, those 10 days, but quite worrying because he wasn't feeding and he was losing weight. And I was
did any of the doctors or nurses kind of pick up on anything? Or
in retrospect, I think the midwives knew, but they weren't allowed to tell you. Yeah, in retrospect, because we had a midwife because I was in hospital 4 or 5 days, obviously, after the C-section. And one of the midwives who was on at night was asking strange questions like, I remember staying up all night trying to feed Ollie from a cup, express milk from a cup, because he just wasn't gaining weight. And her saying, have you got any Chinese ancestry? And roaring with laughter. And then my husband saying, yes, we do, as a joke. Which then confused her and us. And I think she was sort of laying the ground for, this baby looks a bit different. And the health visitors at home would come in and take him to the window and examine his feet. I now know they were doing the Down syndrome checks. They were examining the space between the big toe and the first toe, because there can quite often be a bit of a sandal gap.
Right.
In babies with Down syndrome. And then you have a single crease very often across the palm.
Mm-hmm.
And you can have brush field spots in the eye. I mean, not everybody with Down syndrome has these things, but you can have what are called brush field spots in the eyes. So little sort of flecks in the iris. And I could, in retrospect, they were doing those checks, but they didn't tell me they were doing those checks.
Do you think they would do those checks on every baby anyway? Or do you think they suspected?
No. Right. No, I think they suspected because he was very floppy. Mm. So babies with Down syndrome quite often have very poor tone. So he was hanging over my hand like a beanbag. And that's very, very common. And but I just didn't know. I was a first time mum. And my brother had had a baby the year before. And they used to do a sleep check, which they called the floppy-dometer. So they'd pick up, see how asleep Emily was by picking up her arm. And if it just dropped straight back down, then she was probably asleep. So the word floppy wasn't an alarm bell to me. Whereas now I know that when people are using the word floppy, that's not good. And when medics are using the word floppy, that's not good. But for us, it was just a cute word in our family.
Did you become more aware when you had your other two children? So when the next one came along, did you realise the difference there?
Yes. Yeah, but actually my brother had a second child 3 months after I had Ollie. And so that Christmas I was so upsetting because we had these two babies next to each other on the bed. So his baby was born December the 8th, Ollie was August the 25th. And his baby could already do more at 3 weeks old than Ollie could at 3 months. So in terms of lifting his head and things like that. So I could see that there was a massive difference. But my mother knew, I mean, she didn't know he had Down syndrome, but I remember my mother in the hospital going, he's not gripping. You know that thing they say that if you can hang a newborn baby off a washing line.
Yeah.
And Ollie didn't have any grip. And I just felt like, you know how you do with your mum? Oh, back off. nothing I do is ever good enough. And now she's finding something wrong with my baby.
It's weird where your mind goes, isn't it? And I do think there is that thing, especially with a mum. I think if anyone else said it, you'd be like, oh, if it's your mum, it does hit slightly differently.
Yeah, you hear it completely differently. Yeah. Yeah.
So 10 days later, did you have to go back into hospital because Ollie had lost weight?
Yeah, then they rang up and they said, bring him back in. I said, actually, I've managed to get him to feed and I'd rather stay here. And they said, no, bring him back in. And I said, well, you know, can't you come here? They went, no, bring him back in. So they already knew, I think, the health visitors knew. And they were cross with the doctors for not having spotted it. Because they'd, in retrospect, they'd asked for the doctors to come and see. But August is a time when in NHS hospitals, all the new doctors start.
Right.
And I'd had a bad operation. I had a bad C-section. So they'd called for the paediatrician to come and have a look at Ollie and she had refused. She had said, while I was in the hospital, she had said, our worry is the mother, the baby's fine. And I guess they were just busy and this person was new. But they should never, you should never, ever ignore a midwife, I think.
Well, they're just so experienced, aren't they?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. That's it. So
how was the news delivered to you?
Well, it was, as I say, it was over this 10 days of what's happening.
Did you know that they thought that or they suspected it at all?
No, because I'd done the nuchal fold test, which was quite new at that time. Weirdly, I'd lain down for the nuchal fold and I felt like I'd heard a voice, like an internal voice saying, your baby has Down syndrome. And I lay down, I went totally cold. And then they did the measurements and they said, oh, it's fine. And I got given the 1 in 10,000 chance. Mm-hmm. And so then I regarded that as you would, 1 in 10,000, as a negative.
Yeah.
But of course you forget there's still a 1 in 10,000. And our little pregnancy group were very unhelpfully saying, using that as a measure of how young you were. So it might be 33, but if it was 1 in 10,000, that meant that you were biologically 25 or something. Yeah, so it's like, oh, I'm incredibly young. All those late nights didn't make any difference at all. So it didn't really occur to me because I felt I'd had the, but I think I knew something was wrong by the end. I just had a feeling, you know, just a mother's hunch. And my obstetrician for the other two was incredibly experienced. And he said, mothers, in his experience, mothers know. And so in a really spooky way. And so Luke, my middle one, the moment I got pregnant, although all the stats were not good because I'd already had a child with Down syndrome and I was older, I just felt completely happy and I felt like I knew it was fine all the way through the pregnancy. And it was, and everything went swimmingly. And then the third one, I didn't feel quite at peace. And he nearly died when he was born. His first cry punctured a lung and, yeah, it just wasn't straightforward.
I didn't even know that could happen.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's my experience. I mean, everyone's story is different. But and I'm in no way psychic or magic. You know, I'm just very, I mean, I'm not someone who knows things are going to happen. I'm not that kind of person.
You're not about to tell us when we're coming out of lockdown or anything like that.
No, I can't. I've got no magic prophetic abilities. But I definitely, with the pregnancies, the first one and the third one, I never felt quite at peace. And the middle one, I felt absolutely fine. And that was the one that had no problems. So,
So after they'd obviously been doing tests and stuff, how did they deliver that news?
Sorry, yes. So then we got called back into A&E and the doctor said, I'm just going to run some tests. I'm going to run a test for Down syndrome. And I said, what? He said, I'm sorry. And I went into shock. And the shock I went into was, you know, shaking, really shaking. And the actress part of me was going, this is so interesting. You know, I'm flapping like I'm trying to do an impression of a goose trying to take off a lake. That's so strange. Next time I have to act someone in shock, I'll do this. And then thinking, no, actually, I won't do this because no one would ever believe that this is what shock looks like. And then they had to take blood from my baby, which, you know, you've done the heel prick test, but getting a blood sample from a small, very small baby. And by this stage, he's only 3 pounds.
Yeah.
So he's gone down to 3 pounds from 8. And, you know, it's just very, very hard to get the blood out. And it's very traumatic procedure for him and for you. And, yeah, it was awful. And the midwife cried. And not midwife, the nurse cried. And
did she cry because he was being tested for that, or because Ollie was clearly in pain?
She cried. She said she cried because we seemed like such a nice family. We weren't, of course, but we seemed like such a nice family. This was such an awful thing to happen to such nice people, was basically what she said.
Right.
And you know, as you know, because you've seen the documentary, this is something. This is like a really unhelpful narrative for families with children with Down syndrome, because the way it tends to go is that it is a tremendous shock and you do feel devastated for a bit, but everybody not only adjusts, but quite often feels their lives are more meaningful and happier for having the person with Down syndrome in it within a certain period, like within a year.
Mm.
And there's, you know, lots and lots of tests being, you know, academic research being done into that. And that is part of the story. And so I think it's, you know, presenting it as a big tragedy stops parents bonding. And also now we have such sophisticated prenatal tests within the termination window. I think it's just really important that it's presented to parents as, listen, you are going to feel really bad and really frightened for a bit, but it's vanishingly rare for people not to be delighted with their family member.
There's an amazing line that you said in the documentary that was, I was delivered a tragedy, but I got comedy.
Yeah, that's definitely true. It's like living with a diva, like with a really comic celebrity. Yeah, it is. And most people would say that. I mean, of course, there's challenges. But I think most of the value, the meaning we get out of life comes from these areas in which we're challenged. Even if it's parenting, I mean, parenting alone, any child is challenging. It's just, it's a slightly different type of parenting. You're doing the whole thing on slightly different scales. And of course, there's, you know, there's more worries, but there are, I think having Ollie has made me live in the present a lot more. And that's something, I mean, we were laughing in the disability community about mindfulness, these mindful colouring books, because we really don't need them, because we're forced to go slow. You're forced to go slightly slower. And you can see that as a terrible tragedy or as the route to enjoying life, having a meaningful and happy life. And I think a lot of mums with special needs kids discover superpowers. So really discover a purpose for existing that they hadn't previously had. There's some amazing, and some of the most amazing people I know at all are within our community. I mean, I've made such good friends. Amazing women who say, you know, they've just really, you know, rolled their sleeves up and got on with it. And, you know, it's like they've been set a mission for their life, which is to make life better for people with disabilities and for other families with disabilities, and to show people how to do it and share resources and fight injustice.
Before discovering all that joy that comes alongside and that community, did you leave the hospital feeling lost, lonely, isolated? Did you feel like, well, the world had shifted a bit?
Yeah, I think my honest first response was, it's a fair cop, Gov. You know, I've had such a blessed life where, you know, I've got a family that love each other, that I've had this incredibly privileged upbringing, seeing all these different countries. I've had an amazing education. I've got a job that I love. I live in a nice house. At some point, something had to happen, you know, to make me one of humanity. and if it's this, that's great. Let's deal with this. But I definitely thought of it as being a bad thing that I was going to deal with all right. And the health worries, and I think there's two different things. One is the learning disability and just being on a slightly different graph. But the thing that was really difficult and terrifying was the health stuff. I mean, that's the downside of Down syndrome, is that there's slightly more suspicion that you'll have heart problems and hearing problems and sight problems and all of that, that the thyroid won't work. And my fears in the first year, I mean, all the airways on a newborn baby are very small anyway, and they're even smaller in a baby with Down syndrome. And so we were in and out of hospital a lot in that first year with bronchiolitis and breathing problems, feeding problems. And I did. I felt very, very isolated. And, you know, new baby groups were awful because everybody else's baby could sit up and yours couldn't sit up. And everyone was trying to be kind to you. And you didn't want them to be kind. I wanted to be complaining about my baby being into things. My baby couldn't move. And my baby didn't babble. Didn't know if he could hear me. I used to sing, go compare for the weighing and measuring thing. I used to hate that clinic. You know, my baby would be like a sack of potatoes on the floor, and everyone else's baby was building with blocks. One saving grace for me was, there were a couple of saving graces, but one of them was Nina Conti had a baby about the same time. She's a comedian, a ventriloquist, and she just lived around the corner.
Right.
We were both doing a radio show together. We were doing the first series of a show called Claire in the Community. And we used to go down together. And I hadn't told, she knew that I had Ollie and that he had Down syndrome, but nobody else knew. But we were both expressing in the dressing room. And I think everyone else on that thought I was incredibly unfriendly because I just came in. I didn't really talk to anybody except Nina. But yeah, it was isolating and strange. But the upside of that, as anyone who's ever grieved anything knows, is that my dad called it a visa system. So we had a visa system for the house. So only a very small select group of people were allowed in. I say house, it was a top floor flat. And but we had such a laugh.
Yeah.
It's a bit like a wake or something. You know, there were people who came round and those four people had keys and could stay over whenever. And
it's that interesting thing about a wake, isn't it? Because you imagine it's going to be something really sad, but there's so much joy and laughter in that. Was there ever a sense of, I guess, not grieving, because at that point you didn't know what it was going to be like and how much joy, because the narrative had always been bad and a negative one, was there a sense of grieving what you didn't think you would get?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I am a girly spod in that I love studying and I always did well in exams and went to Oxford. And privately, I mean, I would never have admitted this, I had intended to hothouse my child. I had fully intended to get the child Suzuki violining, speaking Mandarin. I wasn't going to admit to that to anyone, but I had I already had the house full of baby Einstein stuff. I remember looking at this brightly coloured, you know, acid coloured playmat, and feeling completely heartbroken and just thinking, well, it could make me cry even now, just thinking, gosh, what was the point of that? There was no point of that. And then slowly realizing that actually I did need that, whereas a child, a very smart child, wouldn't have needed that. But actually I needed to be stimulating Ollie in a way that the other child wouldn't have needed.
Mm.
But yeah, it was very isolating. But I also don't think it's particularly helpful. I think it's so interesting how these narratives are really shape the way we interact with our child.
Yeah.
And there's a very strong grieving the death of the child you didn't have narrative. And I don't know that that's that helpful either. Because it isn't a death, and you have got a little baby there that needs your attention. And it was that baby that you knew in the womb. It was that baby that you were feeling kick.
Yeah.
You know,
I just wonder if hearing that from you, so if anyone was listening who's going through something similar, because I imagine that not knowing how you get to a place where you do absolutely fall in love, and not fall in love but kind of accept where you are and absolutely love where you are, so bridging that gap and that, what, taking that step, I imagine every part is it kind of, everything evolves, and because there is that narrative that you do so beautifully, do everything you can to kind of get rid of that narrative, or not get rid of it, but kind of show everything in a very different light. And you show the joy, you show the love, you show the magic. And
but I think it is difficult. Mm. And I think we are the Cowpole generation, where we expect not to feel any pain.
Yeah.
And I think that, I mean, quite apart from whether someone decides to go ahead with the Down syndrome pregnancy or not, I think that that is really the route to A, joy, and B, meaning. You know, overcome, you know, running a marathon is more painful than ambling to the chip shop. So which one is going to give you a sense of meaning and achievement and long-term health?
Mm.
So I think it's a bit like that. It is harder. I don't want to pretend it isn't hard.
Yeah.
Because it is sometimes, but it's immense. You know, I'm really grateful for the ways in which Ollie, all the things Ollie's taught me, and the ways in which I've had to grow. I feel like he's made me live the life I intended to live when I was 18, but wouldn't have.
Because life got in the way.
Yeah, but also I think I would have just pushed my child towards Suzuki violin, and I would have had these expectations. I mean, because I can't get him, it's like trying to blow a boulder up a hill. I just can't get him to be anything other than himself. And so he's made me a better parent for the other two, because I know I just have to, you know, I know I'm just the ground in which they grow, as opposed to them at all in any way. You just have to, there's this thing they teach you when you're teaching your child to talk, which is a painful process, owling. Observe, wait, and listen. Well, you literally, you're not allowed to speak. You just have to watch them and wait for them to talk and for them to lead. And then you join in. And, you know, I don't do that most of the time, but I do remember to do it sometimes. And I think that's really, that kind of attention is really beneficial for both the others.
Mm.
I'm sounding like I think I'm a successful parent. I'm a terrible failure of a parent. I fail every day, 1,000 times.
I usually get off phone calls like this when it's me doing all the talking, and not that I ever paint that I'm a perfect mum, because I always say that I'm not. And then I go downstairs and it's absolute chaos, and I just feel so far removed from whatever has just nicely been spoken about upstairs.
Yeah, exactly. I think something, you know what I wish someone had said to me when I was at the beginning of the parenting journey, was that all of these strategies are time limited. Because it's so depressing. You implement the pasta in a jar behavior reward system, and that only works for 6 weeks. Then you go, well, I want to jump off a cliff, because that was so painful to implement, and it's only lasted 6 weeks. But all of these things only last a very short time.
So true. So we have a star jar, and I'm just like, whenever I whip that out, I'm like, I'm on it. And this is game changer. Life is good. And then all of a sudden no one listens. No one cares. It's a star in a jar. Who cares?
Yeah, exactly. And you need to know that's how it is.
Yeah.
These things, the kids change constantly and they get bored very quickly. And all these things only last for a few weeks. So don't bother buying any of the books. I'm sorry if you've got one out, but don't bother with the books, because whatever you read in the book, that'll only last a few weeks.
Yeah. Luckily, I don't do advice books. I do, yeah. Hands up, I'm really rubbish at this. You know, this is all, yeah, my honest account books, not on advice.
Yeah, those books are really, I mean, they just make you feel bad, don't they?
They do, because they tell you that a one size fits all.
Because I think it's all about your relationship with your child and learning to become the expert. I think we as parents need to reclaim the expert badge. Like My Contented Little Baby, or whatever that was called, that book, that's just a very damaging book to give to a new mother. I mean, I just think the idea that you should get up at 6:30, express 50 mils from your right boob, sterilize everything, make your own breakfast, wipe down all the surfaces with Milton, make your bed, have a bath, wake baby. I remember holding the book in one hand and this practically purple, you know, this blackberry, human's blackberry screaming. And it said, settle the drowsy baby. throwing the book across the room. Really, it's up to you. It's up to you. You can read the baby. The baby can read you. The baby needs you, not a manual.
I love it.
Okay, I have two new obsessions that I need to share with you. Impress No Glue Press-On Manis and Impress Press-On Falsies Lashes. Trust me, these are getting ready game changers. Both require no glue, so there is no damage to your natural nails and lashes, no mess, and no annoying dry times. Just one step and you're done. Boom. Instant glam. Visit impressbeauty.com/presson and use code PRESSON25 at checkout for 25% off Impress manicure and Press-On falsies.
What's the age gap between your three?
3 years and then 5 years. So 8 from top to bottom.
So what has it been like bringing more chaos into the fold?
I think a friend of mine, this is not my words, a friend of mine who has four kids said to me that every time it's like you build a tower of wooden blocks and then you think that the next baby's going to fit in, but the next baby knocks it down. You have to start from scratch every single time. So you have to work out all your, you have to have a different pasta jar, start. All the family routines, they all start again with every new baby. Mm. So, yeah, I became weirdly obsessed, and I think you do find this sometimes in families with kids with special needs, that I really wanted Ollie to have two siblings. I thought either we have just Ollie and I pour all my attention into him with all these early interventions and teaching him and to get him as far along as we can, or he has to have two siblings because I don't want to leave one sibling as a carer. I want them to have each other to talk about if I'm not here and their dad isn't here. So, and then I just kept miscarrying. So I had, you know, just found it really, really hard to have those babies. But again, it's just made me very grateful. So I suppose rather than feeling down about there being chaos, I was just very grateful that we'd finally managed to get the two siblings, to get the family of three.
And what has it been like having them all growing up together?
Well, it's different every 6 months. Do you find this?
Yes.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, you have these sort of mental photographs. I mean, at the beginning, it was fantastic with Ollie and Luke. There were 2 3/4 years between them because they used to do speech therapy together. So Luke was about 10 months old and already talking. This weird talking baby, like one of those media videos, they're one of those adverts that goes around. And yeah, they were such good friends for a really long time, probably until Luke was about in year three, and so Ollie would have been year 5 or 6, and then the gap started to get different. I think it is hard for the siblings to process, because they don't see Ollie as any different from them at all.
Mm.
And that's the magical thing. They don't. And so I'm differentiating discipline expectations. And Luke's going, this is completely why are you expecting me to do this and not him? And so we started to get more arguments then, and they dealt differently with the new baby. And now Ollie and Tom play really nicely together. And I think Luke's found the transition from being the middle one to essentially being the older one much harder than I ever imagined.
That's interesting.
I think we don't know how, you know, birth order is so important, isn't it, to our identity. Mm. And that's something that's a bit confused for Luke.
I always think second child, middle child, I always think it's a really difficult role anyway. Because you're not the oldest, you're not the youngest. So you kind of, I don't know, float along. Well, not float along, but you're kind of struggling to work out what your role is. And I imagine being pushed into, then you definitely have a role. This is the new role. You're kind of like the leader, if you like. It must be a bit like, whoa, this isn't what I signed up for. I'm middle child. I'm meant to be difficult and middle. And now I've got to be, you know, responsible.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think I've had to... Or I've been aware that he really, as I said, close to my brothers. And so he's got a cousin, the cousin who was born in December, that, you know, that Christmas I was talking about. So Charlie is pretty much the same age as Ollie, and he performs that big brother role for Luke.
Aww.
So that's the thing, you know, the cousins are all incredibly close. And I don't think, although my brothers and I are close, I don't think the cousins would be as close as they are if we hadn't had Ollie.
Mm.
Because I started doing family holidays for the cousins years ago. We used to go to, there used to be a Down syndrome camp, speech and language and riding camp down in Kent. So I used to rent a big house and all the cousins would come and stay because my brother and sisters-in-law were working. So the cousins would all come down and we'd go and drop Ollie off and then we'd do castles. So it was the Castles holiday. And they started doing that when they were quite young. And now we still have one or two family holidays all together every year, go and rent a big house and they hang out. But that all came from Ollie's speech and language camp.
How do you talk about, Ollie's Down syndrome? Do you talk about it a lot?
Yeah,
we do. Not a lot, but being aware of it.
Yeah, we talk about it. We talk about it all the time. I think that is partly because we did the documentary, but I don't know if I made the right decision or not. I mean, it's a difficult thing to know what the right thing to do is. I mean, some families don't talk about it. And you know, I think I'm probably the young, I spoke about it earlier than most of the other families we know. But it was quite funny, my initial attempts. So I remember saying to Luke, the thing is, Ollie's very special. And he went, Mum, am I special? And I went, yeah. Yeah, you are very special. So it's like, okay, we'll park that for now. We'll do this another time. And then I went, Ollie has something called Down syndrome. And Luke said, and do I have Up syndrome? Because he just wouldn't understand Ollie as being in a different category to himself. And I think I came to realise that he had the right view and I had the wrong one. That Ollie's, you know, we're all just human beings and we've all got different characteristics. Mm. And the only thing that the Down syndrome label is useful for, really, is, you know, I suppose, you know, testing before birth, if you think that's important. I mean, I personally am not a big fan of it, as you'll have gathered. And getting the right education. But even getting the right education, to really deliver the education that Ollie needs, you need to look at Ollie as an individual as opposed to someone with a label. So really it's just about unlocking the cache. So having the label means it's a bit easier to fill in the forms.
Well, and that makes total sense as well, because every child is different.
Mm. Yeah.
So every child without Down syndrome would have different, you know, needs. So, you know, it's no different.
And I think, you know, the way a lot of parenting is counterintuitive, like if you're really angry, speak very quietly. And I think it's a bit the same with education, that people are worried when they're... you know, if there's kids with disabilities in their class, that their child won't get attention. But actually the child with a disability comes with a support, which means that, and their support shouldn't be on them all the time. So what it means is you end up, particularly in primary school, with an extra adult teaching in your child's class. Mm. So Ollie's class, all the way through primary school, there was the teacher, the TA, and then Ollie's LSA. And there were a lot of kids who weren't getting, you know, who didn't have a label that unlocked support in the way that Ollie did, who benefited from Ollie's LSA. And I can think of at least two that the local authority hadn't signed off for them to have support, but who then went into speech and language groups with Ollie and got the special attention that they wouldn't otherwise have got. So it can be a massive plus. Mm. For a class to have a child with a known disability in there who comes with a care package.
Yeah. But that wouldn't even occur to me, I don't think, that there was any...
It's amazing. Parents in our community who've had mums come up to them at the school gate and going, why isn't your child in special school? Your child shouldn't be here writing... Some people are kind and some people are really not kind.
Yeah.
But when you take, you know, quite apart from the thing of, you know, let's be nice human beings, even if you're just being incredibly mercenary about it, it is a, you know, it can be a real plus.
Mm.
Just like it looks like it's going to be a bad thing for our family that we have this child with a disability, but actually it's bonded our family. We've done some really amazing things that we wouldn't have done if we didn't have Ollie. We've learned things we'd never know. My kids have, you know, had difficulties they wouldn't otherwise have had, but it's also given them, they've overcome them and it's given them resilience. And I'm doing a sales pitch now. I'm I'm doing a Down syndrome sales pitch, which I don't mean to do. It's just, I think the things that I suppose the only point I want to make is that the things we think of as being specifically bad have ended up, you know, although being challenging, bringing with them specific benefits that you wouldn't have thought of beforehand.
I listened to you on another podcast, actually, and you were saying how the boys will kind of come together and almost make Ollie play up sometimes, like exaggerate.
Yeah, Ollie pretends to be more disabled to make people laugh on the bus. It's awful. I'm going, Ollie, stop it. And everyone's looking at me like, oh, she's so mean. I'm going, Ollie, behave normally. And they're going, he's got Down syndrome. Can't you see?
Yeah. And has there ever been that feeling of, and I wonder for the boys as well, of people staring or looking or anything like that?
Yeah, definitely there has. But it's hard to prize it apart because people stare at me anyway.
That's true.
Yeah. But yeah, people have stared. But I mean, everyone's had that, haven't they? Their kid melting down in the supermarket.
Yep.
Yeah. But I think what happens now is that Ollie's just so social. He's desperate to bond with people. And at the moment, he's desperate to bond with alpha males. So every man we meet, he asks them what football team they support. And what's interesting is you go, oh, that's why they all support them. It gives you a real insight into being a bloke. And he can actually, although he can't have complicated conversations most of the time, he goes on the Chelsea fan app and he types his opinion about every game. And he's typing in the same level of language as everybody else. And I think that must be because Chelsea must have a lot of foreign supporters who don't speak English very well. But he fits right in. I mean, it's absolutely, I don't know what that's saying about Chelsea fans. No one else in the family supports Chelsea, by the way. Just out of nowhere.
How did Ollie start supporting Chelsea?
Nobody knows. Yeah.
That's so funny. After being told so many things that Ollie wouldn't do, he wouldn't be able to do, is it absolutely amazing? Like, well, I'm putting those words into your mouth. What is it like seeing Ollie surpass all those things or just kind of do those things that you were told that he might not be able to do?
Well, you go through phases, like with every child. So at the moment, I am going through a phase of being very worried about Ollie and being very worried about the things he can't do because he's about to leave school. And, you know, but in year six, last year in primary school, he was in the top 10% of people with Down syndrome, the things he was achieving. And he really looked like he was going to be the first generation who were living independently and working a job, but secondary has been a car crash for us. I think it's a sadly common experience, I just feel like I'm looking at a very different child to the one I was in year six. But hopefully, you know, swings and roundabouts. Yeah. Hopefully he'll, because I hated secondary school as well. Hopefully college and the next level will be kinder to us.
I imagine it's a big shift as well, being the oldest in the school to suddenly the youngest. You know, it's everything is new again.
There is, I think secondary is a shock for all children. But schools just don't have the training. I mean, obviously they need resources, but really it's attitude as much as anything. So one of the big things is teachers get obsessed with the gap between their child with Down syndrome and the rest of the class. But the gap is completely irrelevant. It's just, is everybody learning? And you can, without too much difficulty, create activities that everyone at every level can do. But they don't have the training on how to do that. And so they think they can't. And they end up, once the self-pity creeps in of, I shouldn't be having to do this, this child should just be in a special school, then it's a bit of a disaster. And kids with Down syndrome do. So they did this study not quite recently in Holland, where they found that, so your average IQ with Down syndrome is around 50. And they found that kids with an IQ of between 50 and 100 who went to special school at the end of that period performed worse in math and literacy tests than kids with an IQ of under 50 who had gone to mainstream. So that's really, really interesting. So that shows how much our children learn from their peer group. And so I really tried to get Ollie in mainstream. And, you know, the first school didn't have, they got rid of their Senko and didn't replace her. And then the second school, there was a clash between the SEN department and the deputy head, you know, discipline. Because Ollie just has no fear and has to be given a very good reason why he should do anything.
Right.
Yeah, so it failed and he ended up in special. And so we ended up with three school changes and it's just been catastrophic in terms of learning. Yeah. I must remember to celebrate Ollie's achievements in the way I did when he was smaller. But it has been a bit of a tough few years. In terms of expectations, because I got so excited because the trajectory was up.
Yeah.
And then it's been tough. You know, I feel like I've been interacting with parenting like a plow interacts with a field, you know, knock after knock after knock. But that's part of the job too, isn't it? And you don't love your kids any less when things are hard. In fact, you love them more.
Yeah, absolutely. It kind of makes you fight for them even more, I think, when you're put in those situations.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So one of the books I wrote recently that is on motherhood was a series of letters on motherhood. So it was letters to my husband, to the boys, to my phone, to my foof, my boobs, like all various parts of me that contributed to motherhood. So I wondered if you could write a letter on motherhood, who would it be to and what would it say?
I would write a letter to a mum who's just had a baby with Down syndrome and didn't know, or who's trying to decide whether to keep the baby. Because I was written a letter by somebody when I had Ollie, somebody I didn't know, who she just told me about her daughter. And it made all the difference in the world. Just, it took so much fear away. She described this, her daughter Domenica at that age was 8 or 9. And she just described her really beautifully. She said, you know, Domenica, you know, she just told us about her journey, you know, Domenica loves the Simpsons. And I just remember reading, oh, she loves the Simpsons. Oh, she's got a great sense of humor. Oh, it's gonna be okay. The idea that I wasn't going to have this vegetable, I was going to have a child that had favourite TV shows and interacted, had favourite foods and went to school. And so I would write a letter to somebody who had just had the diagnosis saying, you know, diagnosis is the worst bit. And here are some of the things. And I would make it very, you know, very specific, very specifically funny. Ollie, the other, you know, lockdown, Ollie hasn't really understood lockdown. And he turned up at a neighbour's house in his pants asking them to take the bunting down from outside our house because it irritated him and he knew I wouldn't. I mean, it's embarrassing. It's really embarrassing, but it is also kind of, it's also, we've got nice neighbours, it's also kind of funny. We have disco breakfasts. Ollie loves Elton John. I don't know, I'd just write that kind of thing, I guess. Ollie's favourite food, what happens when Ollie cooks, Ollie's jokes, Ollie's sense of humour. I mean, they're jokes that just, they're things like, what's a fisherman's name? Dave. What? It's a joke that's only funny because Ollie, it's not funny. Like, and when people patronise him, we went to a hospital. We had a a check for something, and I took him for ice cream afterwards. And we went into this restaurant near Tommy's at Waterloo, an Italian restaurant. And the waiter was trying to be kind, but he was being really patronizing. He's like, "Oh, you like ice cream? What you like?" And Ollie sort of looked at him, and he would never have realized. It was not unless you know Ollie, that Ollie was winding him up. But he said, "What's your name?" And then Ollie looked up with one eye and said, "Jeff." "Hey, Jeff, well, what ice cream you like, Jeff?" And I don't know. It's just funny, really, really funny. But he, you know, he's much more emotionally wise than people would realize. And yeah, so I'd write that kind of thing. A letter to take away fear.
Yeah.
And to just sketch out a bit, because what happens is you get given this awful piece of writing. I think it's awful piece of writing. I got sent it about 10 times. And it's something like, you're supposed to go on holiday to Italy. You've wanted to go to Italy your whole life. You can't wait to taste the pizza and eat the ice cream. But at the last minute, your plane is diverted and you have to go to Holland. And you're really cross because you've always wanted to go to Italy. But after a while, for some reason, you're not allowed to leave Holland.
Right. You're just there.
You're just stuck in Holland forever. And you realize that Holland does have things to recommend it. They're not as obvious, but they're, you know, this is this piece of writing you get given. It just winds me up.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't, I don't think it helps. So, yeah, so I would write a letter to somebody saying, don't panic. It's going to be okay. Hold on tight.
Yeah.
Hold on tight. The grieving bit is awful, but I promise you come out of it. And 99.8% of people who come out the other side are delighted with their family member with Down syndrome and wouldn't change them for the world.
The last few years, I've been really aware of the Wouldn't Change a Thing campaign.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they're great, those people.
Yeah, just so wonderful to see. I think because it's never been on my radar. I don't really know anything. All I'd seen is that, not that I believed in it or anything, is that negative storyline. And I think actually years before that, sort of being out and seeing different families and seeing that joy, actually seeing it, and then the Wouldn't Change a Thing campaign sort of really sealed it for me. Kind of like, yeah, you can see that joy, you can see that connection between the different families. And I think it's people like you and those families sort of saying, look, this is us, and we are more than happy.
And I think it is, you know, it's obviously every woman's choice, and I don't think you should force people to have babies they don't want. Yeah, it takes a courageous person to choose it. And now you're going to be required to choose it. So I didn't know I was having Ollie. And most of my cohort didn't know they were having. They may have done the tests, but the tests weren't as accurate. Now the tests, now every pregnant woman is going to be required to become a bioethicist. You're going to be given all these choices. I mean, you can sequence the unborn baby's genome from the tests that we currently do. So you're going to know, in the future, we're going to know, you're going to be able to see how Italian your fetus is.
Right.
Like, oh, this one is 64%, you know, has 64% of my dad's genes, and this one has fewer. A guy I spoke to in the States was saying he was really happy. He had sequenced his unborn child's genome and got into trouble for it, but you won't soon. That he was really pleased his kids were 55% related. Because he and his brother were only 38% related and they didn't get on.
Right.
So there's all kinds of choices on the horizon. And the reality is that there's very few people, I think, who are going to choose to have a child with a disability. And so our community is very possibly going to disappear. And there's a wonderful culture that comes with people with Down syndrome, which you can see, you know, we see Andrew on The Greatest Dancer, or Sarah Gordy acting in The A Word, or the Wouldn't Change a Thing campaign. There's a load of positives to having Down syndrome, a load of wisdoms about being a human being, and a load of huge bonds and blessings for families that are going to go. I suppose we feel a responsibility to tell people what our experience is, so that if someone's inclined to make that step into the unknown, they know that there are plenty, plenty sunny days ahead.
I think it's wonderful. Honestly, yes. I think it's so wonderful.
It's so meaningful. You'd have seen me screaming at him the other day.
You mean that still happens? Oh, dear. I keep telling myself that as they get older, I'm going to have to be screaming less. But no.
Well, puberty is a magical time.
Of course. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, puberty. And, of course, that coincides with perimenopause for most of us who are having babies later.
Yeah.
So your hormones are going crazy. Their hormones are going crazy. And that's an entirely new box of treats.
Amazing.
On the horizon.
So we end every podcast with you completing three sentences. So the first one is, being a mum means?
Being a mum means seeing your child wearing your Malone Soulier shoes with a veruca and going, oh, well, never mind.
Since having children, I
have got an entirely new value system. So I think my kids have broken every single thing I treasured.
Yeah.
But I now treasure entirely different things that are of no monetary value to anyone except me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've got to say, those two kind of tie together. And I definitely feel like even now in lockdown, I'm like, yeah, we can play with that. Like, there's no, you know.
Yeah.
What's the point? We can absolutely, that's going to bring you joy for a day. And that is perfect, 5 minutes. And that piece is worth it. And the final one is, I'm happy when?
I'm happy when, well, I'm happy lots of the time, but I'm really extremely family happy when we're sitting around a table, having a meal together and having a conversation, which we can do now, listening to each other and making each other laugh, telling each other jokes.
It kind of comes with the territory of being around a table. I don't know whether it's a boy thing or whether it's a children, just put them at the table with food. Suddenly everyone's that little bit more relaxed. Words start tumbling out.
Yeah, I love that. And I also love bedtime chats. I find boys talk to you when you're not looking at them. So lying next to them in bed and just chatting, tickling their arms or whatever, those chats are really precious. And I've just reinstituted, I screamed the other day, I'm rebooting this family. I'm turning it off and turning it on again, trying to return to factory settings. And so I reinstituted washing up club. Our dishwasher broke in lockdown, which is great. So we did washing up club. And although there was a lot of fighting the first time, the chats we had, and it came from, none of my friends have to do any housework. And, you know, talking about being an adult and how it's so important to be able to wash up and manage your own, you know, sail your own boat. And that was, I don't know, it's so weird, isn't it? That's what I mean about a different value system. That felt like, I felt on top of the world. To have got them contributing, doing chores, having a conversation about moral values and being your own person and the kind of house, you know, talking about their futures as adults. I felt so ridiculously happy. I can't tell you.
Sally, thank you so much for coming on.
So nice to chat to you.
Lovely to chat to you. Thank you.
No worries. Take care.